un fond d'écran alors.
Welcome everybody. Today it's a pleasure for me to have here Cyril Petrou, who is a researcher at the Institut d'Astrophysique de Paris. I know Cyril since his PhD. Actually, he started his PhD when I was finishing, or when I just finished my PhD at IAP, working with supervised by Jean-Philippe Houzin. And then usually, Cyril, I introduce the speaker and I ask the speaker a short CV. I didn't ask you the CV. I hope to remind you where you went for the postdoc. And then Cyril did a postdoc in Helsinki.
Oslo.
Oslo, not Helsinki. And who was Helsinki? Philippe van Niet, Oslo. But anyway, Oslo, sorry. And then you moved to South Africa, right?
Portsmouth.
But working with people in South Africa.
Yes. I spent a few months in South Africa.
Ah, okay, that's right. And then you got a CNRS position right after, right?
Yes.
At IAP. Working on the primordial cosmology. And then today he's going to summarize the status of the measurement of the primordial deuterium. Talking about the precision of the Big Bang nucleosynthesis synthesis. You have 25 minutes to speak. I invite everybody to stop Cyril at any moment and eventually to ask questions using the chat.
Yes, so thank you, Carlo. So yes, today I'm going to talk about precision Big Bang nucleosynthesis. It's a work I've done at IAP with some collaborators, Alain Coq, Jean-Philippe Buzan, my PhD advisor, and Elisabeth Vangeny, who are, Elisabeth and Alain Coq are working in nuclear astrophysics. Okay, so next slide. So the idea that the chemical elements, that is the nuclei of atoms, have been formed in the early universe dates back from 1948, from this very famous paper, this paper by Alpha, Bethe, and Gamow. And in this paper, it's one of the founding papers of the hot Big Bang model. They give the ideas that the universe can have a thermal history, and in this thermal history, one of the consequences that they find in 1948 is that chemical elements have been formed. Then I've added a question mark here because, you know, in this paper, they really thought in 1948 that all chemical elements have been formed in the early universe. We know that it's not the case today. We know that only some light elements have been formed in the early universe, and the rest of elements have been formed in stars, essentially. So you only have helium-4, which has been formed in the early universe. 24% of helium-4 has been formed in the first 5 minutes. Some traces of light elements I'm going to talk about, but then all the heavy elements are formed in stars, and elements which are heavier than iron are formed in stars, star explosion, binary neutron star merger, and so on. So I'm just going to talk about this small part of the elements which have been formed in the early universe. So why did they have this very beautiful idea that everything could have been formed in the early universe? It's really coming from the fact that in all nuclei, except proton, of course, because it's hydrogen, because this is just one proton, in all nuclei, you have neutrons. And a neutron is an unstable particle, which has a decay time scale of 880 seconds. And so if you want to form, for instance, helium-4, at some point, you need to transform a proton into a neutron. So here you see this is a PP chain in stars. It's an image I've stolen from Wikipedia. And you have that proton plus proton gives deuterium, and in deuterium is neutron plus proton. So here the color code I'm using is neutron is blue and proton is red. And in this transformation, in this fusion process, then it's a weak interaction process. So we have transformed a proton into a neutron, and this releases a neutrino. That's why we receive neutrinos from the sun, and a positron to conserve the charge. However, the idea is that in the early universe, when the universe is very young, at least much younger than the decay time scale of the neutron, then we might have neutrons in the early universe. And if we have neutrons, then we don't need to have this very slow process, because this process is very slow, because it's a weak there is a weak interaction which is taking part. However, if we have neutrons, we can directly fuse neutron plus proton into deuterium, and deuterium has a binding energy of 2.2 mega electron volts, and so this releases a photon of 2.2 mega electron volts. So the question is, when does it happen that we have neutrons and we can form these reactions, and how many neutrons were available? Because the amount of chemical elements we are going to be able to form depends on the abundance of neutrons in this early universe. So this is just to remind how we are going to talk about chemical elements when we're doing nuclear physics. Since what matters is the number of neutrons and the number of protons, we always use this kind of chart where we put elements with the same number of protons, for instance, hydrogen, helium, on lines, and then you see on each line you have the isotope. So for instance, here you have hydrogen, deuterium, you even have tritium, which is not represented, and helium-3, helium-4, and so on and so on. So when we're going to talk about nuclear reactions, we're going to talk about nuclear reactions using this chart. So what's the difference between the basic, most basic nuclear reaction and chemical reaction? So I would say that the most basic nuclear reaction is proton plus neutron gives deuterium plus first photon. Because once you do that, then the neutron is not unstable anymore. Once it's trapped into a deuterium, then it's a stable particle. Well, the very basic difference compared to some chemical reaction is that in some sense, the most simple chemical reaction is proton plus electron gives an atom, neutral atom, plus photon. But then the binding energy is of the order of the few electrovolt when we're doing this chemical reaction, whereas when we're doing a nuclear reaction, it's of the order of the
Well, I cannot hear you anymore, Cyril. I'm the only one.
No, I have the same problem.
Ah.
Same here.
Yeah. I'm gonna send him an email. Oh, well, maybe you can stop the recording.
Okay, good. So then, in order to know when we have this energy scale, we need to look at the Friedmann equation. And the Friedmann equation is what gives the relation between the scale factor of the universe and time. And it basically tells you that the Hubble rate, A dot over A, is related to the energy content, energy density of the universe. And in the early universe, then the early universe is completely dominated by radiation because the energy density of radiation is scaling like 1 over A to the 4. And so when you solve this equation, just A dot over A to the square is something proportional to 1 over A to the 4, you find directly that the scale factor is doing like the square root of time. And knowing that, for instance, for a black body or for relativistic particles, the energy density is going like temperature to the 4, then you find directly that the temperature to the square is going like 1 over time. And so this means that to go from the electron volt scale to the mega electron volt scale, so you have 6 orders of magnitude, then you need to look at the time, which are 12 orders of magnitude earlier in time. And so this is what you see in this graph. This is time, the scale factor as a function of time. So here it's today. So it's the time is given in years. So you have a few 13 billion years today. Then the electron volt scale is when the universe became transparent, when you had recombination of electrons and protons, and when the CME was formed. It was when the scale factor was approximately 1,000 times smaller, 0.001. It corresponds to a few times 100,000 years. But then the mega electron volt scale, because it's 12 orders of magnitude earlier in time, then it's just a small fraction of year. And in fact, it's such a small fraction of years that it's just 1 second. The mega electron volt is 1 second after the Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And why do we need to wait to wait until this time to be able to form nuclei in the early universe? It's because whenever you have photons which are too energetic, that is, which have energies which are more than 2.2 mega electron volt, then they would destroy deuterium and they would destroy all the other nuclei. And so you cannot form nuclei. So you need to wait till the temperature drops below the mega electron volt scale to be able to form nuclei. So that's drops below the mega electron volt scale. So now the universe. And for this, you can understand this very easily from basic statistical physics. So just think about these social experiments. So social experiments, just give 100 euro to some number of people and just let them exchange freely. That is, they can buy, sell, give. And you look at the result of the number of people who have some amount of money. So you see initially everybody has 100 euros. And then once they exchange, you see that gradually, gradually, you can see that you're going to reach the red curve. And of course, this red curve is what is the Boltzmann factor. So what you get is this. you get in then you find that the number of people who have some amount of money, M, is exponential minus capital M, or cap money, and statistics, nuclear reaction, chemical reaction. We have conservation of the energy between the initial state and the final state. If, and that's the second condition, if we have here the reactions which control...
Hello, Cyril?
Yes?
I'm sorry, I had some problem to hear you. I hope to be the only one with the same with this problem.
You're not the only one.
No, you're not the only one.
Okay.
You know what? I will go in my...
Yeah, maybe with like that it is better if you do not have the full screen. You know.
Let me come back.
I think it's not a matter of full screen.
Bon, je vais devoir faire mon séminaire ici, mais c'est pas grave, hein. Faites juste pas trop de bruit, parce que la connexion elle est trop pourrie dans la chambre. Comme ça, on va pouvoir voir que j'ai un niveau anglais vraiment déplorable. Je vois pas, mais bon, c'est bon. Okay, so I was. So, did you listen this slide or not?
No.
I was commenting this slide. So, what I was saying that to answer the most important question for nucleosynthesis in the early universe, that you need to know exactly what's the number of neutrons, the abundance of neutrons compared to the abundance of protons, and for this, you need to, this is controlled by weak interactions. So, weak interactions are interactions of that type where you have neutrons plus neutrino, which gives proton plus electron. Or the reverse reaction, proton plus electron gives neutron plus neutrino. And if you have enough interactions, then you reach a statistical equilibrium, and this is just given by the Boltzmann factor. So you have the neutron, which is given by exponential minus energy divided by the temperature. And this energy, because we are at temperature, which are around the mega electron volt, is only the rest mass energy of neutrons and protons, because around the mega electron volt, they are fully non-relativistic, you know, the rest mass energy of proton is 938 mega electron volt, and for neutron is 939 mega electron volt. So you can really replace the energy by the mass. So which means that the abundance of neutron is exponential minus 938.2 divided by kBT. And for neutron is the same, but with 939.5. And just the very fact that this mass of neutrons is slightly larger means that then you have a reduction factor. So the abundance of neutrons is exponential minus 1.3 divided by kBT. Multiplying the one of proton. So which means that for temperature, which are much larger than 1.3 mega electron volt, you would have as many protons as neutrons. But then for temperature, which are much lower than the 1.3 mega electron volt, you will start to have less and less and less neutrons. And this is just from statistical physics. It's just from the very fact that neutrons are heavier. And so you will have just less of them because they are less likely to be produced. So the statistical equilibrium is the dashed curve. So on the top, you can see the energy scale. You have 10 mega electron volt, 1 mega electron volt, 0.1 mega electron volt. And on the bottom scale, you can see the time. So it's 0.01 second, 1 second and 100 seconds. So you see that everything happens in very early universe. And then here you have the neutron abundance. So you see that at high temperature, very, very small time, it's nearly 0.5. So which means that you have as many neutrons as protons. And then it drops because precisely you have a reduction factor. But at some point, the truth is not given by the statistical equilibrium. So the true abundance of neutrons is not the dashed line, it's the continuous line. And you see that it gets frozen around here just because we don't have, these weak interactions are too weak to enforce the statistical equilibrium. And so we reach a plateau here, you see? That is, these interactions are frozen and we reach a frozen abundance of neutrons. But it's never really fully frozen because neutrons, when they are free, they can still decay because they are unstable. So that's why it keeps decreasing here. See, it keeps decreasing. And this is the neutron beta decay. Neutron gives neutrino plus proton plus electron. But then at some point, then after, let's say, 2,000 or 3,000 seconds, then because of the neutron beta decay, you would have lost all the neutrons. And if you have lost all the neutrons, then you don't have ingredients to form nuclei. But fortunately, what happens is that then the deuterium synthesis can take place around here, around 0.06 mega electron volts, so slightly below 0.1 mega electron volt. And at that time, then you can see that around that curve, we have approximately 12% of neutrons. Okay, you see? And so, and why can we form deuterium? Because at that temperature, there are no photons left which can destroy deuterium. So I told you that the photons which are 2.2 mega electron volts, they can destroy deuterium. And because we have so many photons in the early universe, we have approximately 1 billion photons per nucleon, that we need to wait for a temperature which is much lower than 2.2 mega electron volts, such that even in the high energy tail of the Planck spectrum, then there is nothing which is available to destroy deuterium. So, and then if you have nothing which is available to destroy deuterium, you can form deuterium. Proton plus neutron gives deuterium plus photon. And once you have formed deuterium, then you can form heavy elements. So you see, once you have formed deuterium, for instance, here is deuterium, one neutron plus proton, then you have a whole network of reactions. So for instance, deuterium plus proton gives helium-3, or deuterium plus deuterium gives helium-3 plus neutron, or deuterium plus deuterium gives tritium plus proton, and so on and so on. And in the end, you will what you will get in the end is nearly only helium-4, because helium-4 has the most favorable binding energy. And since initially you had approximately 12% of neutrons, and since for helium-4 you have two protons and two neutrons, then it means that in the final state, you will have approximately out of 100 nucleons, you will have approximately 76, which are still in the form of protons, so hydrogen, and 6 helium-4. And so the fraction in mass of helium-4 will be approximately 24%. And so that's the great success of the primordial nucleosynthesis, is to be able to explain why we have nearly 24% of in mass of helium-4 in the early universe. So here it's the same plot as before, but instead of using a log scale for time, it's a linear scale in time. So you can see the fraction of neutron which is decreasing, then it's frozen, you have beta decay, and around approximately 3 minutes, around 180 seconds, then you start to use these neutrons to form deuterium. And once it's used to form deuterium, this deuterium is used nearly immediately to form helium-4. And this is the fraction of helium-4. You can see that after 5 minutes, nearly all the neutrons have. And basically after 5 minutes it's over, nucleosynthesis is finished, and then nuclear reactions will take place only much later in stars. So everything happens between 3 and 5 minutes, and then after it's over. Of course, you have a whole network of reactions. I showed you just a few reactions which produce helium-4, but then you have other reactions, and so you would also produce some barium-7 and lithium-7. And so typically what we do in Big Bang nucleosynthesis or primordial nucleosynthesis is we produce this kind of chart. In blue lines, we have the theoretical prediction, which depends on the baryon's abundance. So it depends only on one parameter, which is baryon abundance here. And then what we plot is the helium-4 abundance, deuterium abundance, it's here, sorry, deuterium abundance, helium-3 abundance, and lithium-7 abundance. And you see that, and then in green, we plot the observed values for these abundances. So we only have good measurements for helium-4, deuterium, and lithium-7. The one for helium-3 is just one point, and it cannot be trusted. But then the thing which happens since WMAP is that now the baryon abundance is very, very well measured by CMB anisotropy. So now what the theoretical prediction is not just the full blue lines, it's the intersection of these blue lines with the Planck or the WMAP, or today the Planck abundance, baryon abundance. So you see that the prediction of BBN is that the abundance of helium-4 should be here, exactly at the intersection of these blue and gray lines. It should be here for deuterium, and it should be here for lithium-7. So you can see that for helium-4, it's working very well. For deuterium, it's working rather well. You can see in this zoom of this part of the plot. And then you have the famous lithium-7 problem. I guess you've heard of that, is that what is predicted by BBN is some value which is approximately 3 to 4 times larger than the value which is observed. And this is one of the big problems of BBN, because we have a great success here for helium-4 and for deuterium, so we trust that everything is working well. But then we have this problem for lithium-7, You can say that the factor 3 is not much, but still it's a lot compared to the agreement of the other abundances. So how do we get these predictions? Well, what we can do is that we solve first for the cosmology, so for time, scale factor, and temperature. Then we compute the weak rates, because I told you that the weak rates control the neutron abundance. And then we solve for the nuclear network. That is, once we know the relation between time, scale factor, and temperature, we can put on top of that the nuclear reactions. And why can we can do this in these three steps and not everything at the same time? Well, it would be possible to do everything at the same time, but it's easier to do this in three steps. It's because baryons are very subdominant in the early universe. And the number of photons is much, much larger than the number of baryons. So we can, to solve for the time and the scale factor and the temperature, we can completely ignore the baryon. We can completely ignore the nuclear reactions. There will be no back reactions of these nuclear reactions on the cosmology. So we can just solve the cosmology first and then solve the nuclear reaction. It's just a technical, technical remark. So how do we solve for the plasma thermodynamics? Well, one of the simplest methods, which dates back from the 60s or the 50s, is to use the conservation of entropy. So the entropy is a function of temperature if we have thermal equilibrium. And so we know that the entropy per volume times the volume, so times the scale factor cube, is a constant. So this gives the relation between scale factor and temperature. Then we solve for the Freeman equation, so the one I showed you before, which gives you the relation between the scale factor and time. And so once we've done that, we have a relation between scale factor, time, and temperature. So we've solved for the cosmology. So then the second step is to solve for the weak rates. So typically when I give this talk, if I have 1 hour, then I would spend 30 minutes then detailing all this computation about weak rates. And because I have just 25 minutes, then I will just be very brief on these weak rates, just telling you that these are these reactions. Neutrons plus neutrino gives proton plus electron. Neutron gives proton plus electron plus antineutrino, etc. And the reverse reaction, so going from the right to the left. And in order to compute them, we just need to know that it comes from this Feynman diagram. So this Feynman diagram of weak interactions, where you have an exchange here of a W boson. So you see that the neutron is transformed into a proton, and in the process, then it emits a W boson, which is captured here by this vertex, and which is transforming a neutron into an electron. So knowing that everything comes from this diagram, it's just a matter of computing the integrals and the rate and the Boltzmann equation and so on and so on. But then from this, we have everything to compute the weak rates, and it's, of course, it's been, people have spent a lot of time in the literature to compute them with exquisite precision. The result is there, is that then in red line, you have the neutron to proton rate, and in blue line, you have the proton to neutron rate. And in dashed line, you have the Hubble factor. So you can see that when the temperature drops below 10 to the 10 Kelvin, so it's approximately around 1 second, then these rates become smaller than the Hubble rate. And this is why these weak interactions are frozen and are not able to enforce statistical equilibrium. So just to say that knowing exactly these rates controls the freeze out of neutrons and controls the abundance of neutrons. Now, the last steps is nuclear reactions. So I'm not going to detail them, but typically nuclear reactions, they are computed for abundance fractions. So it's a number of a given species divided by total number. And typically there's just a balance equation. So we're saying that the abundance of some species is just the result of all reactions which are creating this species, this first term, minus all reactions which are removing this species. And then of course it's huge works to compile what are the cross section, the reaction rates, and so on. So that's why I've worked with nuclear physicists, because precisely to know, to because for this, you know, to have very good measurement of this of these rates, and you know, you need to compile all this publication, because each experiment is a measurement of cross section, so you need to combine all these experiments in order to get cross section and so on. So there is a huge work in getting these reactions, but once you have them, you just need to put them in the code, and then it's just an ordinary differential equation, because all these species depend only on time, because we are working in homogeneous cosmology. And then typically the kind of plot you produce for BBN is this thing. You have the evolution of abundances as a function of time. So here you see it's time, 10, 100, 1,000 seconds. You see that in black line is the neutrons. So you see at some point they are used, told you, to produce deuterium. Deuterium is the red dashed line. So you see deuterium is first produced. And then it's directly used. That's why its abundance is decreasing. And it's used because eventually everything ends up in helium-4. And in dashed blue line, you can see helium-4. So and then the final state is that you have nearly only helium-4, and then you have only some very small traces of helium-3, deuterium, barium-7, lithium-7, all the other elements, you only have tiny fractions. Everything ends up nearly in helium-4. But this here, my talk is about the status of deuterium. So I told you that deuterium is produced and then it's destroyed. Okay, so here I'm skipping the slide. So produced, I showed you, it's produced by the reaction, which is neutron plus proton gives deuterium. And then it's destroyed essentially by three reactions. The one in green here, deuterium plus proton gives something. Deuterium plus deuterium gives helium-3. And deuterium plus deuterium gives tritium. These three reactions are crucial to compute the destruction of deuterium and then to get what's the final abundance of deuterium. And they are very crucial because you can see this is the deuterium sensitivity. So typically the relative variation of deuterium is some number which is of the order of 1 or let's say 0.5 times the relative variation of the cross-section. So whenever you have 1% of error on the cross-section of one of these three reactions, you will get, let's say, 0.4 or 0.5% of error in the prediction of deuterium. And so you need to measure these three reactions with great precision. And so the remarkable achievement of this last year is that there has been an experiment, which is called LUNA, Laboratory of Underground Nuclear Astrophysics, which has computed one of these three key reactions with exquisite precision. In the past, it used to be the less known reaction rate. And now you see that this experiment has measured this cross-section. And these are the red dots. So you see that the error bars have shrunk. And also what is more important for us is that not only the error bars have shrunk, but also it has been measured in the energy range, which is the most useful for BBN. So now there is an agreement among everybody computing BBN that we have a very good measurement of this reaction rate. And using this new reaction rate, we have updated our paper from 2018. So this used to be the agreement of the deuterium. So this is deuterium prediction in blue. This is abundance prediction of baryon coming from Planck. So you see that somehow the theoretical prediction of BBN is there. It's the intersection of the blue and the gray line. And you see that it's approximately in agreement with the observed value of deuterium. Now, updating these reaction rates, then you see that we start to have some disagreement between here and here. Conversely, what you could say is that ignoring what is measured by Planck, you could use BBN to constrain what is the baryon abundance, and you would infer that the baryon abundance as measured by BBN would be slightly smaller than what you would get for Planck. So that's why we said that there is a beginning of a tension. We're not saying there's a huge problem, but there's a beginning of a tension due to this new reaction rate. So that's why this is the paper we put on the web, a new tension, and we are just showing that we get a slightly different value. Then the very same day, you have this other paper where they say basically the opposite. They say, oh, given this new reaction rate, we have an excellent agreement with the Planck. So how is it possible? Well, then there was this third paper, and they said basically, of course, because now that we have measured with exquisite precision this one of these three reaction rates which are destroying deuterium, then we have other reaction rates. This deuterium plus deuterium gives helium-3 and deuterium plus deuterium gives tritium, which are the dominant sources of error. So the bottom line here, and that's the end of my conclusion, is that now what we really need to say if we have a problem or not in the BBN and in deuterium, what we need is to have measurements of these two other reaction rates, which are as good as the one for this reaction rate, deuterium plus proton gives helium-3. Okay, so I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Cyril, for this nice talk, despite the difficulties you had with the connection.
Well, could you hear me once I went in the living room?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah, your living room is fine. So is there any question or comment? Please, Samuel.
Yes, thank you for the presentation and the update on the BBN that I had not looked for a while, so it's nice to see what has been happening. But one comment, or maybe it's a question, I don't know, but so you show that it changed the result now that you implement this very good effective sections on the reaction. But what does it mean that the error bars on these effective sections were underestimated in the past? Because if you create a tension or if you remove it just by changing the reaction rates, it's it, I mean it seems that we had something wrong in the previous one. So if
you look, so this is the previous one. If you look here, so here the error in the blue line is really coming from nuclear rate uncertainty. So you can see it's slightly larger than here.
Okay.
So in fact the reason why we start to have a beginning of a disagreement is that in the past we have larger error bars. So from even the Planck here, this paper is from 2018. So we used Planck result of 2015 because Planck 2018 was released in July, and this paper was early 2018. And so Planck results have an error bar which has slightly shrunk and which has slightly moved on the right. And here our error bars on the theoretical prediction of the term has slightly shrunk because on this three reaction rate, one of these three reaction rates, we have now, a rather small. So now you can see that the thickness of this blue line here is really due to the uncertainty on the two of the reactions.
Okay, I see it. But the dashed line
here on this plot, this is the previous. This is the previous prediction.
Okay. Thanks. But so this is for deuterium. But then for the lithium problem, will it change anything? Because it seems to be very far away. So the reactions.
The problem on lithium 7 is a 300% problem. So
it will be much bigger than the certainties that you are.
We have it has changed. This new reaction rate has somehow changed indirectly lithium 7, but by a fraction of a percent. So
yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Cyril, how people does it measure the deuterium abundance?
So you see that what I didn't explain because I didn't have time, but what you measure is the ratio between deuterium and hydrogen. So the reason is that people look in the spectra of quasars. So you look at quasars which are bright enough, and then on which you have good spectra. In this spectra, you measure the various lines of elements, and then So you have many quasars, but then you select only the quasars on which you have very low metallicity, because then you would say that the clouds which are crossed by this deuterium then are of primordial origin. You know, if you have too many metals, then it means it's not primordial and you cannot use it. So once you have found quasars which have low metallicity and which have a high redshift, then what you can look is at one of the lines, I forgot which one, but of hydrogen with respect to deuterium, because since they are the same atoms but with that are isotopes, then deuterium has the nucleus of deuterium is neutron plus proton, whereas the nucleus of hydrogen is just a proton. So they would have the same, and the reduced mass of the electron would be slightly modified. So all the lines of deuterium are the same lines as hydrogen, but slightly shifted. So you don't know the amount of clouds which are crossed, but then you can still compute the ratio between deuterium and hydrogen by measuring the ratio between these two neighboring lines.
And I guess that any possible bias of selection of the sample quiz, etc., is taken into account within the error bars, I suppose.
So yes, in the conclusion, we're saying that clearly there are three possibilities: either it's coming from the baryon abundance, or it's coming from the measurement of the term, or it's coming from nuclear reactions. So the fact that there are so many conditions on the quasars, if you look,
all that is within the error bars.
So the quasars which are used, there are only seven of them. So they have been measured by Cook et al. So it's a Tim Cook, Pettini, and I forgot. And so you see there are these five red points, and then they have a new one here and a new one here. So there are, I cannot criticize the measurement because I didn't do it. So I don't know if there is a bias. I can say is that there is no redshift dependence, and also it's very high redshift. So redshift equals 3, there would be nearly no, I think it's very, yes, these ones are very good.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a question, please?
Sure.
Cyril, could you repeat your argument where you distributed 100 euros to everybody? This is the point where you got cut off.
Yes. So I said you give 100 euros to everybody, and then you just let people exchange freely. So they can, if you give some money to some people, then the condition that there is no loss of money. And then you just wait. So first you look at the number of people having some amount of money. So since you've given 100 to everybody, then everybody has 100. And then when people start to exchange, there will start to be people who get richer, who get more, and people who get poorer, who get less. And after many, many exchanges, so I did this with Mathematica, after many, many exchanges, then typically what you get is this. The number of people having some amount of money would follow the Boltzmann distribution, exponential minus m divided by m, where m is the average money per person. And for this, the only hypothesis is that there are many, many exchanges, of course, and that nothing is lost. That is, whenever you some people give money, then I mean you're not allowed to burn notes, or not if you're not allowed to lose money, then eventually, just if everything is random, eventually then the distribution of people having some amount of money would follow a Boltzmann factor, exponential minus money divided by average money. And so what I'm saying is that in the early universe, then it's the same thing, except that what is conserved within interaction is not money, but it's energy. So somehow you can view neutron and proton as being, you know, if you have the isospin view of what is a neutron or proton, you can say it's two states of the same particle, one state with some low energy, which is 938.2 megaelectron, and one state with high energy, which is 939.5. You can view it like that. And so because this weak interaction, they will keep exchanging these states, neutron plus neutrino gives proton plus electron. And so eventually, if you have enough of these reactions, you will reach the same statistical equilibrium, but except since what you exchange is energy, then you will get exponential minus energy divided by average energy. So it's just to illustrate that the only hypothesis you need is that you have many exchanges, so many reactions, and that energy is conserved. And so as soon as one of these hypothesis is not satisfied, and typically it's to have enough interactions, then you are losing statistical equilibrium. So that's what's happening here. Early in the early universe, you have many weak interactions, so you are following the statistical equilibrium. But at some point, then statistical equilibrium tells you that you should have less and less and less neutrons, because since neutrons are heavier, then they are less and less likely. So, but at some point, you don't have enough interactions, so this abundance of neutrons gets frozen. So the interactions are not able to enforce a lower and lower neutron fraction. So at some point, you reach a plateau, you freeze the neutron fraction.
Thank you. Very nice.
Any other question or comment? I don't see messages in the chat, neither raised hand. So in this case, we can stop here, and thank you again.